My name is Mark Seiden. I'm an internet security consultant. I've been a programmer for about 40 years now. When networks were invented, I became a network engineer. And about 15 or 20 years ago, I started doing information security. But when I was an undergraduate at Columbia, I was a locksmith. During the days of the 60s, there was a lot of student unrest at Columbia, and I worked for the radio station. So we had to report on the unrest. And the best way to do that without getting tear gassed or beaten up ourselves was to make keys to the tunnels under the campus and keys to the buildings, which I did. So we reported on the student unrest in the late 60s. We got a Peabody Award, and I taught myself how to be a locksmith, and I've used that skill ever since in breaking into places with permission for my clients. Hacker has a number of definitions, including many old and honorable definitions, which involve exploring the limits of systems, and I would say proudly that I am a hacker in the most honorable of senses, that is, trying to find out what the limits are of systems and exploit them for the benefit, for amusement and the benefit of humanity. Clients hire me to try to find bugs in their systems before the bad guys do. And this is bugs at every level of description of that word. For example, design issues, architectural issues, implementation problems, things that are installed but not correctly, for example. So I do these kinds of reviews from the point of view of a guy who wants to steal something. I try to find the weakest link in the chain and exploit it. And often this is a dramatic demonstration to a client of what a real bad guy could do. There are actually very few companies that don't have secrets these days, although many of them don't know how to identify what their secrets are when you ask them. Most companies have problems these days. Some of them are in denial, so they won't be addressing the problems. Some of them have tried and not gotten adequate resources to address the problems. It just requires, you know, there's so much legacy that they have to redo, and they can't get the investment to do it until there's some embarrassing incident, perhaps at their company or one of their competitors. Even when companies believe they're problem-free, they have problems. The best thing a company can do is hire different people to look at their security every few years, because even if they've been assured by, say, a Big Four accounting firm who's looked at their security several years ago, they've probably changed their system since then, and different eyes looking at the problem will see different things. So that's the best reason to have different people take a look each time. Sometimes companies feel they have good security, but they can't really persuade themselves why that's the case. So you ask them, prove to me, you know, I'm your customer or I'm your partner. Prove to me why you're trustworthy and why I should give you my business. And it's very hard for them to tell a good story. So when you look at it from top to bottom, you try to do the analysis and figure out if their story is good, if they have basic competence, if they know how to address problems, or if it's not a good story. Another issue is that often companies don't know how to address problems when they arise. They don't have an incident response plan. Perhaps they've been lucky enough never to actually have an incident to address. But then when one happens, they're sort of frozen in the headlights like a deer, and they have no idea what to do. Companies that are more mature have a mature process in addressing incidents, and they do drills, for example. You know, often someone will move to another company that has been a client of mine before, and I've done defensive work for that client, and then they'll say, well, we already have all the defenses in place. Why don't you try attacking them and see how well they work? And the attack is not just sitting down at a laptop and running scanning tools and other kinds of exploitation tools. It's also trying to social engineer my way into the place and trying to do physical security break-ins. So there's usually some kind of loophole which will allow you to get in and exploit something in the system. Then there's also the insider threat, which most companies try to minimize, which is that trusted insiders can decide, say, that their salary isn't high enough or they happen to be in need of money and decide they want to sell the company's secrets or the client's secrets just for money. And this has happened way too many times. It's also happened at outsourcers and offshore vendors, where the law is not quite as clear as in the U.S. about who owns what information. There used to be this idea of a perimeter in the same sense as a physical security perimeter. You might have a moat around your fort, and you might have walls. Well, there were things called firewalls once upon a time. There still are, but they don't protect things that well for several reasons. One is wireless access points. People will plop down these $30 or $50 wireless access points on their inside network for their convenience, and wireless is not all that secure, particularly if it's not configured extremely carefully. Another problem is virtual private networks and having to work from everywhere at every time. People somehow expect that they should be able to have access to all the corporate net resources from their living room. But this also means that their teenage kids and their friends might have access to the corporate net from their living room. Another problem is bad networking protocols. For example, multimedia protocols, teleconferencing protocols, which involve opening wide gaping holes in the firewall just to make them work. So these are badly designed. They're not really designed for security, but they're designed for functionality. And the effect is that people can use them to circumvent security. Then there's the insider threat. People on the inside can often communicate outside, and when they can do that, they might, for example, open an active connection to the outside, which could be used by a bad guy, deliberately. Another problem is spyware and malware. If you can convince somebody to go to a website and download some program, that program could leak information from the inside to the outside. And this is directly the fault of Microsoft, which has designed an operating system which is friendly to such attacks. So this combination of things means there's high risk in just using simple firewalls and not additional safeguards. There's another example also, which is backup tapes. In the last few weeks, there have been practically every day there's been a disclosure of a loss of backup information on a tape containing some kind of personally identifiable information, often in transit, sometimes from a storage facility. I've been predicting this for years. This is a single point of failure in the entire financial infrastructure of the world. It's these backup storage facilities, which there are relatively few of, and the couriers that take the tapes back and forth between data centers and the backup storage facilities. So the only practical solution for preventing this problem is to encrypt the backup tapes. And everybody should be doing that right now. So even if they're lost in transit or lost from the storage facility, it's a computationally intractable problem to figure out what's on the tape. In many of my penetration tests, it's a multi-step procedure, but a lot of it is based on successes in the past. First, I'll do a design review and an architectural review of the system which is being tested. So I'll sit down with the engineers, and they'll walk me through how it's used by customers, how it's used by trusted insiders, where the important data, the secrets are, what they are they, how are they protected? And this would be something that many insiders at the company would know. So a disgruntled ex-employee might be able to leverage this kind of information even years later to break into the system. It also might be possible for an insider, even a cleaning person or a contractor, to be able to make use of this of similar information just by watching what people do or reading the contents of their desktops and find out how the system works. So with basic knowledge of how the system works and no privileged access, at that point, I usually come up with scenarios for how a bad guy would exploit the weaknesses in the system, which by then are pretty evident. I mean, you can see the possibilities that somebody would exploit. There's a kid who just graduated from Waterloo named Jonathan Westhues, who reverse engineered the badges that you use to get in. And he built this little gadget, which costs about $50 to build in parts, which will read your badge if he walks up next to you in the elevator, and will also replay the bits on it into the badge reader. So all he has to do is stand next to you in the elevator, read your badge, watch what floor you get off on, and then go to the same floor 30 seconds later, and put his little gadget against the badge reader, and he'll walk right in as if he were you. So all of these access tokens are a little bit flaky, and you know there are ways of circumventing those sorts of things. Okay, so you look for the weaknesses in the system, and you try to exploit them. Of course, you do this with permission and with a get-out-of-jail card. So if anybody figures out that you're illegitimate and busts you, at least you get out of jail, right? You don't end up going to the pokey. I guess I've observed over the years, this is my rule of thumb, that about 10% of the locks in the world are misinstalled or broken, or otherwise easily exploitable in some way. Because locks actually have to interact with the real world. There's this system composed of the lock and the door and the hinges and the walls and multiple doors. It's real legacy stuff. It has to fit exactly right or it doesn't work. It has to be installed perfectly, and nobody ever tests the locks. Then there are simple issues like, where are the keys? There's usually a facilities manager who has a master key to the building or the department or the floor in their coffee cup. It's usually in the coffee cup. Sometimes it's in the desk drawer. Usually this facilities manager is too low on the totem pole to have a private office. They have a cube, so the keys are in their desk drawer. In many of my penetration tests, I've stolen the keys from the facilities manager over a weekend, for example, and then on Monday morning, I drop them on the desk of my sponsor, who's usually an executive at the company, and I say, well, here are the keys to all the buildings in New York, and the building in New Jersey, and the building in London, and what do you want to do with them? The right answer is, let's let them stew. Let's see what happens. And usually nothing ever happens. Nobody ever says a word. So in one of the recent cases where I did this, we went back to the facilities manager afterwards, about a week later, and said, did you lose a set of keys by any chance? He said, why, yes, I did. Where are they? This guy didn't even report to anyone that he'd lost the physical keys to the firm, which could have gotten anybody into every office in the place. All they needed to do was get into the building. Not exactly hard. Another issue is that physical keys can be relatively easily made. All you need is a few instances of a lock to take it apart, and you can figure out what the master key should be. And it's relatively easy to find a few locks that aren't carefully protected and walk away with them. So if you see missing locks in your hallway, on the bathroom, or somewhere like that, probably somebody's walked off with them for a purpose. So physical locks are completely obsolete. Another example of obsolete technology is passwords. And everybody uses passwords. And everybody reuses their passwords everywhere. So if you use your password for your company at a public computer in a, say, a cyber cafe, chances are good that someone will sniff it. And then they will try to steal your identity, will try to break into your company, will try to steal your PayPal account, your credit cards, and your banking. And this just happened to a client of mine who happened to be in a hotel in a South American country and used the public computer in the lobby of the hotel. And guess what? Somebody hijacked his PayPal account and his Hotmail account, and they tried to hold it for ransom. They wanted $100 so he could have his Hotmail account back. The solutions that are under an individual's control can be simple. For example, use random passwords and write them down on a piece of paper in your wallet. Use different passwords at different kinds of sites. Use different strengths of passwords for different kinds of sites. For example, you might want to use a different password for your financial institutions than you use for ordinary public websites. You can't trust the people at the websites to actually safeguard your password. They have to store it so they can verify who you are. But why should you give them the same password as you use for the bank? A bad guy at some random website could record your password and try logging into the bank as you. Maybe you even use the same login at the bank as you use. Another thing you can do is generally try to maintain a low profile and be a private person. Don't respond to requests for private information, telephone interviews. Teach your whole family to be paranoid and just say, no, I don't do market surveys. I don't answer questions on the telephone. Send me something by mail if you want me to answer the questions. Because often these surveys are designed to extract a little bit of important private information from you in a blizzard of perfectly ordinary, innocuous-seeming information. Just give us the date of your birth as verification that we did this interview, that kind of thing. I do a lot of debugging the process, because if you can figure out who has access to data and where the data flows, then you can try to figure out what the vulnerabilities are. Who could get to that data while it's flowing among the components in the business process? Now, at some point, you actually have to look at code, because all code has bugs. And the bigger the program, the more bugs there are. So, of course, you look at code, you do selective code review, and you run tools which look at the configuration of the devices and make sure that all the patches have been applied and the configuration is tight rather than loose. And you also, at the same time, try to test the incident response of the organization. If you try to do a technical break-in, you know, from like a 13-year-old kid, script kiddie, will they notice? Will they respond? Does it set off their alarms, or are there no alarms? Or do they see it and say this isn't important? Suppose you succeed. Do they take countermeasures? Those are all sort of interesting, important questions, more so when there's money at risk or people's personal information. It shouldn't be the case that a problem is only recognized several months after it occurs. People should be not asleep at the switch. They should be watching. They should be watching what's going on. They should be more diligent about it than that. If they aren't, you shouldn't have a business relationship with them. You should cancel your account and go to a company that's a little bit more careful about your information. So at some point, security will become a distinguishing feature of products. People will be able to say, here's our security story. We do better than the competition. We spend more money at doing this, and we'll protect your privacy better. And the people who care about that sort of thing will actually go to them. At least that's the hope. Unfortunately, these days, people seem willing to sell their personal information for a few dollars or coupons or discounts. They don't seem to think that it has much value. U.S. companies value their customers' personal information because it gives them great understanding of the customer's behavior. And it understanding your customer, knowing your customer, is extremely valuable these days because you can market to them the things they might want. If somebody hasn't bought shoes in the last year, chances are they're going to go out and buy shoes one of these days, especially if they tend to do it, once a year. Or maybe they haven't bought eyeglasses recently. Or maybe they buy coffee at the brand X coffee bar, and you're trying to attract them to the brand Y coffee bar. So, you know, all of these behavioral trends make it possible to understand and market stuff to your customer. But also, understanding your customer means you can limit their fraud risk. For example, let's say you're a seller at an auction site, and you always log on from New York. Once in a while, you log on from California, and you sell stuff in a certain category, say books and CDs, average value $50. But suddenly you're logging on from Romania and selling different kinds of brand new computers, average value $1,500 or $2,000. This is a fraud flag. Unfortunately, eBay doesn't have the mechanism in place to notice this is a fraud flag. So, often these fraudulent ads will be up on the site for several days before somebody points it out and complains, or a vigilante puts in a bid of thousands of dollars for something that's only worth a few hundred to make sure no sucker will buy it. The personal information of customers that can be used in identity theft is a liability these days because of a California law that requires disclosure of loss of this kind of identity information. That's why we're seeing these stories about loss of backup tapes, for example, or backup tapes gone astray. Now companies have to report it. Previously, they just hid it. So now companies realize they have to protect this kind of information at risk to their reputation. You know, one example of government regulation is the requirement for Social Security numbers being supplied at every drop of a hat. A Social Security number is something that it's very difficult to change once an identity theft gets it, and it's required pervasively. So it's a really poor authenticator, a really poor identifier, and in general, it shouldn't be used for anything other than retaining your Social Security earnings, but now it's used for everything. So it's time to replace the Social Security number with something more durable and more, which can be kept as a secret, as a true secret, and only used for specific purposes. There's no reason, for example, why you need to supply your Social Security number to the Motor Vehicle Bureau as the same identifier, why it has to be used for all your health information. There are some things for which technology intended to increase efficiency is not a great benefit. in voting, I think many expert people in computer security are extremely worried about electronic voting machines, about the fact that there's no basis on which to trust them without something like a voter-verified paper ballot. I mean, why should you believe that the machine is recording what you push on the buttons unless it produces a piece of paper which can be recounted if there is a question? Another argument is that elections should actually be solemn rituals. They should be slow. They shouldn't be instant elections. They should take a few days to count, and we should wait for all the returns to come in, and we should count the provisional ballots, and we should count the absentee ballots. And, you know, we don't have to announce by the end of that day who's the president. We could wait a couple days, and the country would not grind to a halt. One of the biggest problems is the spyware and the malware problem, and that is, at the moment, mostly an artifact of Windows. Windows is this big fat target. So people could actually protect themselves best by switching to alternative platforms like the Macintosh. It's very hard to keep a Windows machine free of spyware and malware. These days, the Macintosh is based on the Unix operating system, and it's believed to be much more secure than Windows is, not just because it's open source, but because the platform is so much more mature. As a side issue, it's a so much smaller target with only, you know, 10 or 15% of the marketplace that many of the malware developers don't think it's worth their trouble to develop exploits for the Mac, even if they could. So it's more difficult and it's less popular, so there's a lot less of a problem on the Mac. So most of the security people that I know use the Mac as a platform. That's a simple way of avoiding a lot of problems. The machine that I carry around with me on airplanes is a Macintosh, and that's what I keep my stuff on.